Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There are reports that militants have blown a hole in a wall at the Egypt-Gaza border, and a stream of Palestinians have been entering Gaza from Egypt. Meanwhile, the sounds of Israeli fighter jets blasting the airport in Beirut, Lebanon again as this new crisis in the Middle East continues. It began with a cross-border raid on Wednesday by Hezbollah, the militant Iran-backed Lebanese political group. Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers. For the last couple of days, we've been reporting on this latest crisis from Israel, and today we move across the border. Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post joins us from Beirut. And Anthony, you write today that the 3 days of fighting so far appear to have crossed a sort of psychological barrier. What do you mean by that?
I think there have often been red lines that seem to demarcate the fighting that's periodically erupted between Israel and Hezbollah over the years. There was especially intense fighting in 1993 and 1996, but this is the first time that the Israelis have attacked the Beirut International Airport, a symbol, I think, to many Lebanese of the country's recovery from the civil war. And it's also the first time that Hezbollah has been able to fire a rocket that could go as far as Haifa, a city that's well inside Israel. I think both sides of the conflict read that as a certain break from the past, and that this is a conflict that I think remains to a lot of people here very unpredictable. You often hear the word impasse or the idea that this is going to drag on for quite a while.
Well, and remind us, Hezbollah controls southern Lebanon and the border with Israel. It's also, you know, a political party with a role in government. Despite the UN directive ordering Beirut to disarm and control Hezbollah, it has not happened. We understand different factions met months ago to talk about how to possibly disarm Hezbollah. But as the New York Times now writes, the nation that wished to disarm Hezbollah is now held hostage to it. First of all, what are people telling you there? What are Lebanese telling you? Do they feel held hostage by Hezbollah?
Well, you know, Lebanese politics are famously complicated. It's a country of incredible diversity. And Shiite Muslims represent the single biggest community in Lebanon. And of course, Shiite Muslims are the constituency that Hezbollah claims to represent. When you ask about the reaction toward the war, when you ask about reaction toward the conflict, I think you hear people most often say they believe the Israeli response has been disproportionate. That the scope of the attacks on bridges, on power stations, on the airport, on roads, the country's basically cut off right now. It goes much further than what Hezbollah did in abducting the two soldiers. That said, I think there's a lot of resentment on the part of Lebanon's other communities that Hezbollah has dragged people into a war that's not of their choosing. Now, when you go to the southern suburbs, for instance, which are predominantly Shiite Muslim, Hezbollah's constituency, you hear a much different story. And I spent the morning there, and here you do hear frustration, people feeling they're caught in war's arbitrary judgments, but at the same time, there is support for Hezbollah, devotion. It's devotion that goes very far, and a sense that Hezbollah is doing the right thing. That's what people there will say, that what Hassan Nasrallah says, the leader of Hezbollah, they usually believe is true, and they will follow his direction.
And remind us of that. Some have said it's because Hezbollah not only has the military strength, but it has filled a social vacuum that the government seems to not have filled.
I think that's right, and there's a lot of levels to look at Hezbollah's support. Now, Shiite Muslims in Lebanon have been traditionally disenfranchised. They were, in fact, referred to as the deprived in the past. That situation changed during the civil war that went from 1975 to 1990, and Hezbollah itself was one of the main agents of that change. I think you often hear Shiites refer to Hezbollah as a source of empowerment, for instance. That kind of psychological support also is joined with Hezbollah's vast infrastructure. Instead, like you pointed out, in southern Lebanon and in the southern suburbs of Beirut, where the government isn't all that visible, Hezbollah fills in the gap with schools, orphanages, clinics, money to fighters who have been killed fighting Israel. There's a deep history between the Shiite community and Hezbollah. And it's a relationship that makes it even more difficult for the government to do what people might be calling on it to do. The Lebanese government can't afford to lose the Shiite constituency. It's a central part of this country, and to simply say Hezbollah must disarm is is kind of a fantasy, I think, at this point. It's a much more complicated formula that would have to be reached to do anything along those lines.
And you make the distinction that Hezbollah represents the largely Shiite South, which brings us to Iran. Iran helped form Hezbollah in the wake of the Israeli-Lebanon conflict of a couple of decades ago. Who do you think the players are now? You know, Lebanon has often been seen as a place where other countries fight their battles. Do you see on the ground the influence of Iran as other analysts do?
I think you definitely see Iran's influence ascendant right now within Hezbollah, probably to a greater degree than Syria, which has been the traditional backer of Hezbollah. I mean, you ask about the players in the region, I mean, it's the traditional players that, you know, that are involved in Lebanese politics. It's Syria, Iran, Israel, and the United States. And to a lesser extent, Saudi Arabia. All these countries are involved to a certain extent now, and they're going to be involved in any kind of negotiated solution down the road. That makes it even more complicated because Syria and Iran, of course, have their own agendas when it comes to the United States and Israel.
How else is this reverberating in the region, Anthony, as you're there in Beirut? I mean, what about the other players, Egypt, Jordan, who both have peace treaties with Israel? We understand that, you know, the countries who have, you know, been favorable towards Israel, suddenly their street credibility is way down, whereas the countries who have been antagonistic and worse towards Israel, their street credibility has gone way up in the last week.
You know, I think you see it definitely. There's a huge gap between the official version of events and countries in the Arab world and what's felt on the streets. And I think, you know, sometimes Al Jazeera will capture that kind of street sentiment. Right now, their news about Lebanon is under the slogan or under the title, Lebanon Under Siege. I think you do see, you know, Hezbollah does enjoy a great deal of support in on a popular level in the Arab world because of what it did in fighting the Israeli occupation from 1982 until 2000. Things like this do play very well in the Arab world, where there's a deep vein of resentment against Israel. Now, which I think you've seen is very striking, though, is there's been very little Arab support from other Arab countries for what Hezbollah did. In fact, the Saudis, Saudi Arabia, a very important country in the region, pretty much disavowed it and said that Hezbollah had provoked the Israelis on this. The most you're probably seeing anybody do is trying to negotiate some kind of return of the two Israeli soldiers, Jordan, for instance, or Egypt. But you're not seeing Arab governments definitely line up behind Hezbollah. In fact, you're seeing the opposite.
Well, in fact, we saw Egypt try to negotiate the return of a soldier from Gaza, the Israeli soldier who was taken by Hamas militants. And Egypt said that, in fact, there was one player that urged the Palestinian factions not to come, to a negotiated closure. He didn't name that player, but everyone assumes it was Iran.
It's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. I think, you know, these groups like, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah, they're non-state actors. They don't operate according to the logic of governments. They're movements. They have a popular constituency, and it's very difficult. I mean, what we're talking about right now, at least with Israel, is that they want Hezbollah to be removed from southern Lebanon. They want the border to no longer be controlled by Hezbollah. They're basically talking about the dismantling of the movement's military wing. That's much easier said than done because it does not operate along the logic of government versus government, and it also enjoys a popular constituency that's built over 20 years and that remains very vital. It remains very energetic, I guess.
By the way, Anthony, most analysts would agree with you that Israel is making a demand of the Lebanese government that the Lebanese government can't fulfill. In other words, you know, to dismantle Hezbollah now. Given that, why is Israel going on this offensive?
It's a good question. And, you know, coming in, you know, being in Beirut, it's hard to say what the logic is behind the Israeli operation. It does, I think a lot of people here, at least, do see this as an impasse, that it's very difficult to see Hezbollah surrendering these two soldiers by force of arms. It's very difficult to see Israel pulling back without having gained something, without having created some deterrent. And like you pointed out, the Lebanese government itself is basically caught between Hezbollah and Israel to a certain extent, mainly due to its own weakness. It just doesn't have the capacity to go out, for instance, and disarm Hezbollah. It couldn't do that. The result would probably be civil war in Lebanon. So, like you pointed out, we're looking at something that doesn't seem to be very easily resolved. And I think that's why you're already seeing people here stocking up on gasoline, for instance, on groceries, on water even, trying to prepare themselves for a siege they think is going to last.
Right. It's something that they're telling you they're used to, having gone through a civil war. But what, if you could speculate, what do you think the exit strategy is? You write about speaking to some Lebanese who sort of say, you know, we're used to this. The battle will eventually end. The people will act like nothing ever happened. It'll go back the way it was before. People who are accustomed to this type of thing tend to forget. Is that possible that everybody will just sort of, that it just sort of peters out?
You know, the Lebanese are famous for being able to maintain life under the worst conditions, even during the Civil War. In the worst days, life went on. And I think a lot of people do. There was a certain bravado there. I mean, I think people do think they've dealt with this in the past. There's also a lot of frustration and anger and fear. I mean, I don't want to understate that. People are worried about what's happening. And I think a lot of people, Lebanese I'm talking about, look with a certain sadness to the infrastructure that's being destroyed. I mean, infrastructure that was very slowly built up after a 15-year civil war. Again, like you pointed out, if there is a solution, it's not an easily visualized solution. It's hard to see what form that solution would take. You asked what form it might take just in terms of speculation, and I don't have an easy answer for that. I mean, you could see some scenario where the Lebanese army does deploy to the border, so it's very difficult to see Hezbollah withdrawing. Maybe there's some kind of coordination between the Lebanese army and Hezbollah along the border, but would that satisfy the Israelis? Probably not. And again, you get to the point where, then what do you do?
Well, and on the other side of the border, we should point out Israelis are building bomb shelters, fleeing the south, with their luggage tied on top of their cars. Do you get the sense that, this does seem like it's impossible to know, but will this ultimately drive more Lebanese into the arms of Hezbollah or ultimately drive them away from Hezbollah in disgust?
I think, to be perfectly honest, I think it won't do too much. I think the people who were upset at Hezbollah before this happened are still upset at them and even maybe a little bit angrier. I think the people who supported Hezbollah before this started still support them and probably support them even more at this point. I don't see it necessarily creating a sea change in attitude toward Hezbollah inside Lebanon itself. In the long term, though, I think it is making more of a priority, or it is making more of an issue, the idea of Hezbollah retaining its arms in Lebanon. And this is one of the central issues in Lebanese politics today, whether Hezbollah has to disarm or not. In the short term, that is unlikely. In the long term, there may be some momentum toward that.
And one last question, Anthony Shadid. In Beirut, the role of the U.S., President Bush has called Lebanon's leader to say President Bush, will urge Israel to try to limit civilian casualties. This is well short, though, of the ceasefire that Lebanon's government had called for other countries to call for. But President Bush has also said to Israel he's worried about the very fragile new democracy, if you will, in Lebanon after Lebanon recently drove out Syrian troops. What are people saying about the U.S., what it should or shouldn't do?
When you talk to people in the Middle East, there is a sense the United States operates according to its interests, not according to principle. And I think when people hear the president's statements, or when they digest what the president said about this, they're going to see that the U.S. has certain interests here with Israel, with other countries that are going to dictate what it does with this conflict.
Anthony Shadid, reporter for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Beirut. Anthony, as always, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And this quick note, oil prices have climbed past $78 a barrel. Even though Israel and Lebanon are not players in the Middle East oil market, the fear is that the conflict could expand in the region, which produces nearly a third of the world's oil. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, issued a statement blaming geopolitical factors beyond its control for the price volatility. Well, coming up next, the view from Lebanon continues, and how are Hezbollah's actions in particular affecting the region? Also, a very strong view of the U.S. or lack of U.S. role in the region. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we now, for more on the situation in the Middle East, turn to Professor Fawaz Jurjis, author of Journey of the Jihadist Inside Muslim Militancy. He's also a professor at Sarah Lawrence College in New York, and he is Lebanese and happens to be in Beirut. Welcome, Professor.
My pleasure.
And you write about something called political Islamist movements, and you have a specific take on them. What do you mean when you talk about political Islamist movements?
Well, what I mean by political Islamist movements are those activists who use Islam as an all-encompassing form of life. That is, to them, Islam is not just a religious element in their life. Islam encompasses all aspects of life, the social, the economic and the political.
But you write this is a broad spectrum of groups, some of whom have accepted the rules of the political game. They embrace democratic principles and they oppose violence.
The overwhelming majority of political Islamists basically have come to accept the rules of the political game. They have renounced the use of violence. And they are actively participating in the political rules in that government. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is one of the largest political organizations in the Muslim world, has participated in elections, and has won a major constituency in the last parliamentary elections in Egypt, 88 seats. Hezbollah in Lebanon is a partner in the Lebanese government. It has accepted the rules domestically. It is active in the social and economic sphere in Lebanon, the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan.
Professor, I'm going to hold you up right there because you mentioned, of course, Hezbollah. And here we are seeing Hezbollah, making an incursion into Israel and kidnapping, capturing two soldiers, Israeli soldiers, a unilateral move without backing of the Lebanese government. So how can you say they've accepted the rules?
They have renounced the use of force in the service of politics at home. Hezbollah, it prides itself on being an Islamist resistance movement. It believes that it not only defends Lebanon, but also it defends the rights of Palestinians and other Arabs. In the last 2 days, the leader of Hezbollah, Sayyid Nasrallah, during a press conference, and he was asked, why did you infiltrate the Lebanese-Israeli border? Why did you kidnap two Israeli soldiers? And he said, listen, you care about two Israeli soldiers. There are about 9,000 Arab and Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners in Israel's prisons. Where is the world conscious? Where is courage? Where is decency? Where is humanity when Israel basically hammers at the Palestinians? What he was really implying is that we are the only resistance movement in the Muslim world who stand up to Israel, who defends the rights of the Palestinians, basically defends not only Lebanese honor and sovereignty, but also Palestinian and other Arab sovereignty as well. But the truth is, I think what Hezbollah is trying to do is basically to really carve for itself a major political role in the political equation. What do I mean by that? You cannot really understand what Hezbollah did a few days ago without understanding the internal Lebanese situation. As you know, in the last 15 months since the assassination of the late Prime Minister in Lebanon, Rafiq al-Hariri, the Lebanese political factions have been involved in a major political dialogue. What to do with Hezbollah? What to do with his arms and weapons? As you know, Hezbollah is the only paramilitary organization in Lebanon that still maintains its armament and weapons. In fact, Hezbollah is more powerful than the Lebanese state itself. In fact, it's the only it's a state within a state. And what Hezbollah is trying to do now by attacking Israel, by capturing the two soldiers, is to basically shift debate from the internal political scene and basically gain influence not only in Lebanese eyes, but also in Arab and Muslim eyes worldwide.
And they've been quite effective. We read, for instance, on the Muslim Brotherhood website, you mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt as another organization that's learned to play by the rules, meaning they've learned how to play by the internal political rules of their own country to perhaps run for public office, but still sees itself as a resistance group. On their website, the Muslim Brotherhood writes, Hezbollah, with its modest military capabilities relative to the capabilities of organized state armies, was able to achieve what several Arab governments did not do while they were satisfied to remain silent about the slaughter of our brothers in Palestine. So what you're saying is that Hezbollah is now speaking to the greater Arab world, perhaps replacing the state in the savior of the Palestinians.
Robin, you're really raising a highly critical, pivotal question. In fact, really since I am here in Beirut now, and I am very much in touch with Arab and Muslim public opinion, in fact, what Hezbollah is saying, listen, Arab governments have failed to defend their people. Arab governments have failed dismally, economically and politically, to defend the homeland. We are the vanguard. The vanguard who basically stand up and defend the rights, not only the Lebanese people, but also the besieged Palestinian people themselves. And in fact, Hezbollah Muhammad's actions have made Hezbollah the most powerful heroes in the Arab and Muslim world.
Professor, we found you a very impartial observer of the Middle East, always in the past. But today you're a Lebanese in Lebanon, a member of the Greek Orthodox community in Lebanon, usually the peacekeepers in the country, a bridge between the Druze, the Christians, the Muslims. Can you look at this situation impartially as you watch what's happening in Lebanon? Fawaz Jerjes, Professor of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College in New York, also author of Journey of the Jihadist, Inside Muslim Militancy, but speaking to us as someone of Lebanese descent from Beirut. Professor Jerjes, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. She once wore a headscarf and sunglasses to disguise herself in a Vanity Fair photo, but today, outed undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame stood glamorous and undisguised next to her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, as they spoke publicly about the lawsuit they filed yesterday against Vice President Dick Cheney, Presidential Advisor Karl Rove, and Cheney's advisor, Louis Scooter Libby, and others. The couple accuses the officials of maliciously leaking Plame's identity 3 years ago, to punish Wilson for criticizing the Bush administration's motives in Iraq. A separate government investigation is already underway, and Scooter Libby faces criminal charges. But this morning, Wilson said the government failed to protect his wife and betrayed their trust. They filed their lawsuit, he said, with heavy hearts.
We are under no illusions about how tough this fight will be. But we believe the time has come to hold those who use their official positions to exact personal revenge accountable and responsible for their actions.
Well, joining us in line from Washington is John Harwood, national political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and also chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. And John, how is Washington responding to this idea of a lawsuit?
Well, I think this is seen largely as two things. One, an attempt by Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson to get what they see as justice in this case, since her career was disrupted, and since Patrick Fitzgerald does not appear to be charging Karl Rove or other members beyond Scooter Libby, the vice presidential chief of staff, other members of the Bush administration.
Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor.
That's right. Mm-hmm. The other way it's being viewed is, in effect, a message ploy, trying to keep this issue alive as we move into the fall election season, because it's in danger of dying out with ordinary voters who don't follow this stuff all that closely. And if the trial of Scooter Libby is delayed into next year, this issue may kind of fizzle in campaign season of 2006, and Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson don't want that to happen. Neither do Democrats.
We also understand that the statute of limitations might run out, so that was another element.
But that's right.
A brief history. Before the war, Joseph Wilson was sent to Africa to investigate claims that Iraq bought uranium from the nation of Niger. He said it wasn't true, wrote a New York Times op-ed piece blasting the Bush administration claim 8 days later. His wife is outed by Robert Novak. She's outed as an undercover CIA agent. Novak just recently admitted that two of his sources were Karl Rove and a CIA higher-up, and that he told investigators who his sources were. Phew, I mean, it is kind of complicated. Does Novak's admission of his sources and the fact that he sang while other journalists didn't and one went to jail, does that trouble you at all?
Not really, and it didn't change the basic understanding of what had happened. Bob Novak also said that when Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor, came to him, Fitzgerald already knew who those sources were.
Well, back to the lawsuit. A spokesperson for Karl Rove said the allegations are absolutely and utterly without merit. But we had a question. Can a vice president be sued? Is there immunity?
there is some legal question about that. And the I do not know whether or not the vice presidential actions is going to provide an immunity that would insulate him from this lawsuit. I kind of doubt it, but that's going to be tested out in court arguments.
Right. John Harwood, national political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, as well as chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. While we have you, just switching gears for a second, Senator Arlen Specter yesterday announced a deal of sorts with the administration regarding the once secret domestic surveillance done by the National Security Agency, the warrantless wiretapping. What do you make of that deal?
Well, it's interesting. There's a big debate underway about whether or not Arlen Specter actually stood up for oversight and congressional prerogatives here, or whether he knuckled under to the administration, given the way that the terms of this arrangement. But I think the bottom line is that the administration has submitted to the right for courts to oversee their request to examine some of these records, and that is a step beyond where we've been operating under.
Right. John Harwood of The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, now we want to take a few minutes to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Richard Krueger of Mansfield, Massachusetts, wrote after our 4th of July examination of the Declaration of Independence with Harvard professor David Armitage. Professor Armitage said that in 1945, Vietnam's President Ho Chi Minh patterned his country's declaration on America's, declaring independence from Japan and signaling he'd fight French attempts at colonization. Richard writes, there's a photo that gives me chills every time I look at it. In it, Ho Chi Minh, America's future enemy, is standing on a balcony reading his country's Declaration of Independence. To one side is the American flag, held up by an American soldier who was a member of a team that parachuted into Hanoi to assess the situation. A band is playing our national anthem. It's important to remember that Ho Chi Minh took classes at Harvard in 1911 before moving to Harlem, where he worked as a baker. He knew this country. There was no need for the Vietnam War. Well, after our piece yesterday on how a California company is trying to make sidewalks out of recycled tires to make them safer for trees and people, Rick Bush from Sturgis, Minnesota, wrote with a question. Rubber sidewalks, interesting, he says. What about biking on them? I know when I've ridden on my high school track, it's not as good an experience in that it's harder to pedal. Well, Rick, first of all, are you sure you're supposed to bike on the high school track? And to your question, we called back Lindsay Smith, founder and CEO of Rubber Sidewalks Incorporated, and asked her.
Rubber sidewalks are much harder than the kind of materials that are used on tracks or in playgrounds. Some people don't even notice when they're riding a bike that they've changed from one surface to another. But if you do notice, it won't slow you down or spoil your fun.
Well, we learned something recently during our interview with Frank Griswold, the outgoing presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church of America. I said to him, may you live in interesting times, leaving off as the old Chinese curse says. Well, many of you, including Mary Previty from Haddonfield, New Jersey, wrote to say, didn't you know that may you live in interesting times is an old Chinese curse? You've cursed the bishop. Well, actually, before the interview, I researched the phrase, and it turns out it isn't an old Chinese curse at all. That idea may have taken hold after Robert F. Kennedy said it was a Chinese curse in a speech he delivered in South Africa in 1966. Some feel it might actually be a blessing. Well, finally, following our interview with filmmaker Peter Frumkin about his new documentary on Woody Guthrie, we heard from Scott Hart of Tucson, Arizona. Scott writes, I was struck at your choice of tunes to end with. I think Guthrie's Remember the Mountain Bed, recorded by Billy Bragg and Wilco, resonates within me more than any song I've ever heard. There's a whole movie in that song, and someone with skill in storytelling could make something masterful of it. I guess that's similar to Guthrie's music for The Grapes of Wrath. He got the whole story in 17 verses. That was Guthrie's genius. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or call, leave a message at 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now.
Resin smells and turpentine smells from eucalyptus and pine. In a dance of twigs we chewed with tangled advanced twine. Trees held us in on all four sides so thick we could not see. I could not see any wrong in you and you saw.
Barbaro is doing better. That's what veterinarian Dean Richardson told the Associated Press this morning. The Kentucky Derby-winning colt, who shattered his leg at the beginning of the Preakness, is fighting a life-threatening infection in his previously uninjured leg. However, Dr. Richardson warns that Barbaro's chances of recovery are still slim. Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times. He's been in Pennsylvania following Barbaro's progress. He joins us. And, Joe, what are your thoughts?
You know, there's no doubt that Barbaro is in tough, and chances of a full recovery are slim and poor. That's what Dr. Richardson said. I think a couple things are going on here. This is an extraordinary colt. It's captured the nation's attention. The Jacksons, who own him, are longtime horse owners, have a history of staying with horses a long time. They're affluent people. They've invested in this for the long haul. This laminitis, which he's contracted in his left hind leg, which was his healthy leg, is really a devastating affliction.
Explain it to us, because we understand that horses walk on the tip of their middle digits, just as you write today, as if a human walks on the nail of the middle finger, and that's pretty fragile in what might have led to this?
Yes, and what they do walk like that. And their hoof wall is connected to what they call the coffin bone, which is right in the center of the hoof. And basically, that hard tissue is given away. Mm-hmm. They did a procedure. He has only 20% of his hoof wall now. And as Dr. Richardson said, his quote was, "It's exquisitely painful." Mm-hmm. And, you know, he compared it to having your nails ripped off and then having to stand on it. And that is your function. You need that hard tissue. A horse needs that hard tissue to move around.
And remind us, the non-injured leg being now injured is not really a surprise, because it's so hard for the horse to keep pressure off the injured leg and put it on the non-injured leg.
Laminitis does develop when horses are recovering from orthopedic surgery on the opposite limb. And it's essentially, Robin, is because they've forced all their weight over that to take up the slack of that right leg that's been in a cast, that's been surgically repaired.
So what happens now, Joe? I know that they're trying extraordinary measures to just try to buy time in the hopes that the injured leg will heal. I mean, how do they navigate this?
It's a judgment call, and they've made no bones about that. They say he is happy, he is bright-eyed, he nickers at him, he's eaten. And as soon as that turns, and if he looks like a miserable horse, they will put him down.
Yeah.
That's what people are always going to wonder, and Dr. Richardson brought this up yesterday, is the Jacksons are going to be second-guessed. If they put him down 2 days ago, people would say you quit too early. If they do it 2 weeks from now, they're going to say you quit too late.
Yeah, and the horse suffered, right.
Yeah, right. But truly, these people are veteran horsemen and doctors. They're doing their best.
Well, Joe, I mean, you write about Dr. Richardson breaking down and trying to compose himself during a press conference. The owners can't even come out in public. There are hundreds of emails, get-well emails posted on the website at the hospital Barbaro's being treated at. You know, for those who might be saying, it's just a horse, can you explain the pull of this horse?
He caught us at a time when we needed to be caught. The Triple Crown is a huge event. His breakdown in those opening yards of the Preakness were horrific and stunning. And to see him standing there on three legs, you know, people do have a pull for animals. And horse racing is the oldest sport in America. Three centuries it goes back, pre-America. And it started with, I think, the very best of us. It's my horse is faster than your horse. So there's this beauty, this innocence, and, you know, he caught us at the national limelight. I mean, I was stunned the opening days of those stories right after. The Barbaro stories were on the top of our top 25 email list, and that's with the ongoing war in Iraq and everything else that goes on in this big world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think people want to see and root for the innocent champion.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about the champion Barbaro, the Kentucky Derby winner who's fighting a life-threatening infection in Pennsylvania. Joe Drape, who covers horse racing for the New York Times, is there. By the way, Joe, you might remember, is also author of the book Black Maestro, The Epic Life of an American Legend, about a famous black horse jockey. Joe, thanks so much for bringing us up to date on Barbaro, and best to you there.
Robin, nice talking to you. I hope we have better news out here.
Yeah, I do too. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. From the Orient to India to the Mideast, it's one of the oldest forms of folk dance, traditionally performed by women for women, sometimes it's said, to ease them through childbirth. But after it came to the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893, Americans began calling it belly dancing. Well, recently, more and more Americans, men as well as women, are learning belly dancing in formal dance classes. Some practitioners prefer to call it Middle Eastern dance, or in Arabic, Raqs Sharqi, the dance of the people. Here now's Lynn Menegon recently spent some time at Connecticut College with three American dancers who had organized a symposium to explore how this dance can move from folk art to fine art.
I'm Nancy Barrett, and my stage name in Middle Eastern dance is Suad.
Does Suad mean anything?
Well, I've been told different things by different people. The last person I know of Arabic descent who asked me about my name said it meant happiness.
I'm Sonia Dunbar. I'm one of the dancers, and I'm Nancy's co-sponsor for the symposium here.
If you have a basic inner crow or dragon where you want to collect shiny objects, this is the art form for you.
These are like belts of coins?
These are coin belts. So people would put them on their hips and shimmy around.
And it's bling.
Yeah, it's bling. One of our teachers here today, Morocco, she's from New York, and she's been doing this for 45 years and studied, traveled to Egypt, traveled to the Northern Africa, been everywhere. She calls it, you know, your inner drag queen, which is not meant to insult anybody. So I hesitate to use the term, but you know, that it is very definitely, you can really assume a whole nother persona, different side of yourself. I'm an epidemiologist. Nobody knows what that is, let alone how to say it or spell it, but I am one. You know, like Sonia's an attorney, and this is, we have this crazy, you know, Jones to study Middle Eastern dance and culture forever. Yeah. When I started dancing, it was in the early 80s, to get a beaded costume, you had to do it yourself. Because if you bought one, there weren't that many to buy, and they were really expensive. And we put coins on our own bras for the coin costumes, and we did beaded. We hand-beaded all our costumes ourselves. Nowadays, there's a probably $1 million, I don't know how much it is, a humongous cottage industry in Turkey and Egypt and some other countries where people, whole villages, make their living making articles of dance, like hip ties and gowns and whatever else, to sell, mostly to Westerners, European folks that do this dance.
How would you describe yourself? You're not Arabic.
I'd like to tell people I'm Arabic in my heart. I love the culture in my heart. The joy of it is, at age almost 50, I feel I'm just getting into my maturity as a dancer and being able to hit my stride and really understanding feeling and expression and the culture.
What is it about the dance that hooked you?
Well, the first thing that hooked me was really the music.
Now, you played me some music, and you immediately got up and danced.
see how contagious it is?
It really is contagious. And I can't help but think, do you think it looks better when you have more presence on stage, when you have more body on stage?
Well, there's a loaded question. Thank you very much.
It looks great.
No, I think that's the, we wear stuff on our hips because it has hip movements and you want to emphasize the dancer feels good, jiggling around, the audience likes it, you can see what people are doing. Sometimes being a thinner person with some kinds of moves works better, and sometimes being a more round person works a lot better. It's like anything else. But the beauty is, you can be whatever. You can be at the round end, you can be at the thin end, you can put a costume on, you can wear a hip tie, and a lot of people are surprised. I mean, I had a comment made to my husband one time when I weighed less than I do now. A woman, we did a show, I've never been a small, petite person. I've always been a rounder person. And the woman made a comment to my husband. They were outside smoking. Oh, they dance so well for such large women. And, like, she was shocked. So, you know, I think that's something, we educate people on. That, oh, my God, I would think, I'd look at you and say you're fat, but you dance beautifully. Well, how come that is? Well, maybe because we've narrowed what we think is beautiful. Who can dance? Who's allowed to perform? You know, wow, how could you do all that stuff? Well, I studied. Then they come take a class with you, and you show them the technique, and they go, wow, I never realized it was this hard to really go beyond the basic stuff. And you're like, mm-hmm.
It's definitely in performance. It's definitely a charisma and comfort issue. I'm from Northern Vermont, and I find a lot of people in my area are interested in it in part as a silent social protest for how they feel about the current world situation, the war on terror, and as their way to say, we're all connected, we're all humans, and this is a way, look how similar we can be through something as simple and as joyous and as expressive as dance.
But what do you hear from Middle Eastern people about your attempts to do this dance? Not necessarily in times of war, but we happen to be in a time of war.
Where I am in Connecticut, there's not a lot of Middle Eastern or Arabic communities that I interact with on a routine basis. The times that I have performed over the years for ethnic audiences, and we've done a folkloric-based dance, people have generally appreciated it and liked it. I don't know. Marisa is in New Jersey. Maybe she has.
Tell me your name.
My name is Marisa Pearson. My dance name is Farasha, which is Arabic for butterfly. And my sense is they are very open to Americans learning their dance. I think in some way they're honored. When you dance for Egyptian audiences, you are jumping headfirst into their culture, and they don't expect you to come out in a harem outfit and shimmy. On the other hand, there's a real dichotomy in the Middle East regarding dancers. Some of these teachers who I saw the year before performing, all of a sudden, they are not performing any longer because they just got married, and it is frowned on. The rising fundamentalism in Egypt, as well as in other parts of the Middle East, has also put the pressure on women that it's not acceptable to be a dancer. So in some ways, we may be helping to preserve some of this dance legacy, which, depending on what happens over there, some of it may be disappearing.
You know, I notice you have a shirt that says in sparkly silver letters, belly dancer on the front, and on the back, on the posterior, shall I say.
It says shimmy machine. I think I wear this to prove to people that we do have a sense of humor. We are purists, but we can laugh at ourselves, and we ask people to laugh with us, because what we do is also a lot of fun.
Here now is Lynn Menegon spoke with dancers Nancy Barrett, Sonia Dunbar, and Marisa Pearson. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.